We've got banks that are too big to fail.
What about oil companies?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Hello from American Public Media in Los Angeles. I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Bill Radke, and you're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Tuesday, June 29th. BP is getting a once-over from the New York Federal Reserve Bank.
Google's relations in China are big, but they could get smaller. And they say a wonder food is a great source of antioxidants. It also could be a test for toxins. That's coming up, but first,
it looks like the center of Tropical Storm Alex will miss BP's leaking oil well in the Gulf of Mexico. But the 12-foot waves the storm is likely to bring could hamper oil containment efforts. Not what BP needs. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson joins us from New York with more on this tail-spinning company. Hi, Jeremy.
Morning, Bill.
BP has lost more than half of its stock market value. How much worse could things get?
Well, every day this spill goes on, Bill, the estimates are it may be costing BP $250 million, and the company has already said it's spent $2.6 billion on the response. Now, what does this mean for those of us who don't own stock in BP? Well, the New York Fed is now looking into what exposure certain banks have to BP, certain banks, and whether any BP bankruptcy, if that happens, could pose a threat to the entire financial system.
Ugh, this sounds both familiar and a little dramatic, Jeremy. What are they seeing?
Well, it's a major player in the energy trading markets, trading physical oil, natural gas, and gasoline, as well as derivatives of those commodities. Now, the New York Fed has been asking financial firms about their links to BP, and sources are saying that those links don't appear to threaten the system as a whole, but some banks are being more careful now in their trades with BP, and those trades are a sizable part of BP's business. This morning, Bill, a JP Morgan analyst wondered whether BP's falling market value may make it a takeover target, though there are questions about who would want to take it over with all of its pending liabilities.
Yes, Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson in New York City. Thanks, Jeremy.
Thanks, Bill.
You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Consumer confidence fell for the first time in 4 months. Worries about the labor market to blame. The Conference Board said its index of consumer attitudes fell nearly 10 points in the month of May. The last number notwithstanding, President Obama and Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke say the economy's slowly getting better and that job growth is important. The president says outside forces, however, are keeping investors on edge.
Unfortunately, because of troubles that we've seen in Europe, we're now seeing some headwinds and some skittishness and nervousness on the part of the markets and on the part of business and investors. And so we're still going to have to work through that.
Home prices rose unexpectedly in the latest report from Standard & Poor's and Case-Shiller. This is the price of a single-family home climbing a little bit from March to April. And here to talk about it is our regular Tuesday analyst, Julie Neiman at Smith Moore & Company. She's with us from St. Louis. Good morning.
Morning, Bill.
You have been our pessimist about the housing market, Julie. How does this morning's news hit you that home prices lifted a little?
Well, very exciting because you've got low interest rates, low prices. These are the lowest in 40 years. Prices are up nearly 1%, so that's semi-exciting. But the problem is the first-time home buyer's credit closing through June is now gone. The punch bowl has been taken away from the real estate party because there's still huge supply overhanging the market.
Well, then let's talk about that home buyer tax credit. Some people are saying, look, here's the proof that that was a boondoggle. The government spent a bunch of money on it, and it was a mirage, and prices are going to come back down. Other people say, well, what it proves is tax credits, that's about the only thing making people buy now at all, and the fragile economy needs that. Bring on more government stimulus. Where do you stand, Julie?
Well, the key thing is it did move a lot of purchasing early, moving it ahead of time. Now you're basically faced with a problem of huge overhang. California, for example, completely over as far as the real estate recession is. New York is still sinking. Miami, condomania, that's going to collapse anyway. But it's a huge overhang of shadow inventory held by banks. The foreclosed, not on the market. You don't want it to depress prices even further. We still have more foreclosures going on. So a new home tax credit simply will not take care of that problem. You have to write it off, and we've got to get rid of this overhang.
Okay, so a little more stimulus okay with you despite the deficits that are scaring a lot of people around the world.
Well, the stimulus has to come in the form of jobs because people aren't going to buy houses until they have jobs and know that they can maintain a mortgage. And bottom line, the U.S. economy and the world economy depends on government stimulus and support, but not this artificial kind. It has to be in the jobs area. The patient is so weak and still on crutches, and the governments are going to be taking away their crutches in the name of fiscal austerity now.
We'll talk more in coming weeks about how to create jobs. Analyst Julie Neiman at Smith Moore & Company, thank you.
You bet.
Congressional overhaul of financial regulations is up in the air because of the death of West Virginia Senator Robert Byrd. His loss means one less Democratic vote, and now Massachusetts Republican Scott Brown is backing away from his support of the bill. One of the criticisms of the financial reform measure has been that it won't prevent the next meltdown. Here to talk about what might cause that meltdown is Henry Blodgett, editor-in-chief of the Business Insider. Good morning.
Good morning.
You are one of those observers who believes that even with these new rules, we are at risk of another global crisis. What might that crisis look like?
I think the reason that people are saying that is that if you took this legislation and you enacted it in 2005, it would not have prevented the crisis that we just had. But hopefully this is just a first step, and we will continue to get more reform over the next couple of years.
Is the biggest danger a crisis that looks similar to the one we just had, or are you seeing other fault lines out there that could be the next problem?
Well, over history, we have gotten actually pretty good at preventing the last crisis. Unfortunately, what happens is the next one will look somewhat different, but it'll be based on the same accumulation of debt which got us into this one.
Okay, so you put your finger on a problem there, debt. Is that all we can really know, maybe all we need to know about the next crisis, is that there should have been limits on debt, on leverage, and there weren't?
The one key component that is similar in just about every financial crisis is too much leverage, and leverage in this case is debt. And my hope is that we will have been so scared by what just happened that it will be many decades before we get into another crisis like that.
But Henry, this legislation creates a new systemic risk council. Why wouldn't that council not be able to prevent systemic risk?
I'll tell you why. For the same reason that the SEC and other regulators completely missed the systemic risk in our system in 2005 to 2007. It was not that nobody on earth saw it. Many economists were screaming from the rooftops. And the problem is that a systemic risk council 10 to 20 years from now will be lulled into the same sort of sense of, well, this is working fine, as all of our regulators were in 2000 to 2005.
Henry Blodgett, editor-in-chief of the Business Insider. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, June 29th. I'm Steve Chiotakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at marketplace.org. We're going to get a take on the global perspective now, what's happening in business and economics around the world, and how it affects us here in the United States. Late last night, Google told the world on its website it's going to make changes to keep its internet license in China. The company threatened a few months back to leave the country, taking exception to Chinese rules. Marketplace's Scott Tong is in our China Bureau in Shanghai to help sort it all out. Hi, Scott.
Good morning, Steve.
I thought Google pulled out. What's going on?
Well, in the words of one analyst, a mess. Google originally was offering censored search results for Chinese users. And as you recall, the company had a change of heart. It said it no longer wanted to voluntarily do the censoring. So then it took Chinese users and automatically sent them to a Google search site outside mainland China that didn't do any censoring. But today, the company said China is unhappy with that solution and is threatening to not renew its license. So Google has now made more changes in an attempt to keep its license.
And what does that mean for users, Scott?
Well, they get sent to a new Google China page inside the mainland, which has no content. But once the user clicks the page, he or she jumps outside mainland China. All very complicated.
No, that sounds like splitting some hairs. I mean, Google's doing all this just to stay in China?
A lot of people I talked to today think so. besides the search engine, Google still offers a bunch of services in China: music, maps, shopping, analytics to track website traffic, and it has a mobile phone operating system in China. It may want to stay, but as one analyst put it, it has painted itself into a corner as far as options.
And what happens next, Scott?
Well, tomorrow, Google's internet license expires in China, and we will see if it gets renewed. Otherwise, Google's China site, as the company puts it, goes dark.
Marketplace's Shanghai correspondent, Scott Tong. Scott, thanks.
You're welcome, Steve.
And now for more analysis, Stephen Levy is a senior writer for Wired magazine. He's with us from New York this morning. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning.
This story, Stephen, sounds so distant to me. I mean, who cares if Google stays in China or not? Should I care about this?
Absolutely. You know, besides having huge implications for the U.S.-China economic relationship, it really concerns whether we're going to have a balkanized internet. You know, China has really taken the lead in saying that we don't want our internet to run as freely as everyone else's. Other countries also have their own needs and own desires to have the internet their way, and it sort of kills the dream to have many different internets depending on what country you're operating from.
Hey, very quickly, in 10 seconds or less, who's going to blink first on this?
I hope that Google has indications that this speed bump is going to work, but I'm not optimistic in the long run for Google and China.
Stephen Levy of Wired Magazine, live from New York. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Meanwhile, China and Taiwan signed a trade deal today that Taiwanese officials call the most important development in their relationship in more than 60 years. The deal gives access to each other's markets, but it's also a big political step for China, as the BBC's Chris Hogg in Shanghai reports for Marketplace.
It's not a complete free trade agreement, but it will cut tariffs on more than 800 goods in the months ahead, with more to follow later on. Some analysts believe this could boost two-way trade by up to $100 billion and in Taiwan create more than a quarter of a million jobs. For China, this was more about winning hearts and minds on the island it claims as its own, says Dr. Tao Wang, an economist in Beijing, because there are many people in Taiwan who would like to be completely independent from the mainland.
As far as China is concerned, if the two sides are more economically integrated, if the people from two sides can understand each other more culturally, there will be less support for independence movement.
But not everyone is comfortable with the new arrangements. On Saturday in Taiwan, tens of thousands of opposition supporters rallied against the deal. They fear it will bind the two economies too closely together. And in the long term, that could be dangerous, they say, for Taiwan. In Shanghai, I'm the BBC's Chris Hogg, reporting for Marketplace.
In Greece this morning, labor unions are staging their fifth general strike of the year. The 24-hour work stoppage is affecting the country's most important industry. Marketplace Europe correspondent Stephen Beard has more.
Thousands of workers have joined the strike, halting ferries, buses and other public services. Their main grievance is pension reform. The Greek government is trying to cut pension benefits. On average, Greek pensioners get 96% of their final salary. Today's strike brought more trouble to the country's biggest port, just as the main tourism season gets underway. Greek and foreign visitors were prevented from boarding ferries. Economics commentator John Serapilis speaking from Athens.
It is a huge problem, because it strikes at the heart of the tourism industry, which is an estimated 20% of GDP here, and it strikes at the heart of good day-to-day running of Greek transportation services.
The Greek culture ministry is so alarmed at the potential damage to tourism, it's offered to reimburse fully any loss suffered by visitors. Catering and other tourist industry workers plan another 24-hour strike tomorrow. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
There are two very important places to the illegal drug trade between Mexico and the United States: exchange houses south of the border where currency's traded, and the local bank here at home. There's a big spread today in Bloomberg Markets magazine on the list of financial firms that help move money to those cartels. Wachovia, owned by Wells Fargo, tops the list. It's admitted to not monitoring international wire transfers closely enough. Mike Smith reported on the connection. He's Latin America correspondent for the magazine, and he's with us via Skype in Santiago, Chile. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Why Wachovia? Was there something that sort of singled out Wachovia in all of this?
Well, Wachovia in the mid-2000s went on a major expansion into the business of handling wire transfers So Wachovia became a dominant handler of transfers out of Mexico by these exchange houses, which turned out to be a big vehicle for the drug cartels to launder money.
They say that they didn't know anything about this. Was something even more sinister going on, do you think? Were there local branch workers who were doing some of this?
Well, we talked to several people who worked in the compliance area of Wachovia at that time, and they all said the same thing, that they became suspicious of these transfers. They informed their superiors, and the people who ran the actual businesses didn't believe them or didn't want to believe them and overruled them and kept those accounts open and kept moving money for these customers, which turned out to be drug dealers.
What did these drug cartels buy with all this money?
Well, the drug cartels have gigantic operations. They sell drugs in 231 American cities. That's according to the U.S. government. So they have significant costs. And the biggest cost for them is to buy the cocaine that they move into American cities because Mexico doesn't produce cocaine. But, of course, this is an extremely profitable business. So they have a lot of cash left over that they spend on living the life of a high-rolling drug dealer, you know, buying houses, buying cars. That's where all this money goes.
What's Wachovia say about all this? Any official response about this?
Well, Wells Fargo, like you said, they're the new owner of the bank. They say that they spent about $40 million making changes and that they are as vigilant as any bank can be.
Mike Smith, Latin America correspondent for Bloomberg Markets Magazine, joining us from Santiago, Chile. The name of the article is called Wachovia's Drug Habit. Mike, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, June 29th. I'm Bill Radke. For the latest look at the markets, go to the numbers at marketplace.org. A fight is brewing in Baltimore over efforts to cut the pensions of police and firefighters. There are similar struggles happening across the country. City and state governments want to balance their budgets. Retiree benefits are a juicy target. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports public employee unions are crying foul.
The battle in Baltimore comes down to a few sentences in the city code.
Article 22, Section 42.
Bob Slijewski of the Firefighters Union says it means his members have a binding contract for retirement.
And the benefits that exist when they enter into the contract can't be changed.
But last week, the city council increased the required years of service and cut pension pay and cost of living increases. It's a pattern being repeated all over the country, says Sue Uran of the Pew Center on the States.
Policymakers have too often kicked the can down the road, not making required payments and increasing benefits without considering the price tag.
Uran says nationwide, the funding shortfall now tops $1 trillion, so governments are cutting benefits promised to workers. That doesn't sit well with Bob Slijewski.
I'm starting to get pretty sick when I read what's going on around the country where people just say it's okay to break a promise.
Expect union lawsuits in Baltimore and elsewhere to block these pension grabbacks. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
And finally, the New York Times reports Germany's Dusseldorf airport is monitoring its air quality using bees.
They let 200,000 bees fly around the airport and then tested their honey for toxins.
So far, it's tested so clean, the honey's being bottled and given as gifts under the name Dusseldorf Natural.
Which is a much better gift name than Dusseldorf Toxin Tester. In Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.